I know there's a little bit of feedback in the background from the guys that are cutting down the trees outside of your house. But I was wondering if you could just take a moment to introduce who you are, Audrey. I always look a bit like, what does that mean? But yeah, take a moment just to tell me who you are. Tell the listeners who you are.
Well, I'm Audrey Mary Parks Shabazz, I guess technically, and on my passport. I remember a few years ago, maybe 4 or 5 years ago, all the parents at our school, that where you and I have had kids, were reading something called The 100-Year Life. You know about it?
No.
I didn't read it either, but what it was introducing to these people who were in their 30s and early 40-somethings the idea that they were going to have many lives, not just a job bump, maybe like their parents or their grandparents had until retirement, and then that's it. And so the idea was that they ought to prepare for these different lives and be aware that they're going to be different lives. Well, that was an eye-opener for me, because they also gave me new definitions of who I was based on who they saw and who they interacted with. And they said, "You're a knowledge curator." I said, "Oh, wow, okay, I'm going to put that up on my resume. That's who I am now. That's not who I was 30 or 40 or 50 years ago." And then as they saw me, and you see me too, talk to someone and then want to go over and grab a book off the shelf because I think they'll like it, or it will play some role for them.
Yeah.
And they said, "You're a bibliotherapist." I said, "Oh, I really like that." So I think on one of my online presences, that's how it introduces me. Audrey Shabazz, bibliotherapist, knowledge curator.
Wow. That's incredible.
But now I think I define myself as the reader of books to children. That's just as important. It gives me it doesn't give me income, but it gives me everything else I need.
Yeah.
But in actuality, in the previous lives, I've been some kind of, not a Middle East expert, because my only Middle East language I have worked in is Arabic. So some kind of expertise on Arab culture and history and so forth, which is the predominant Middle East and North Africa, all North Africa. And then a classroom teacher, and then a teacher of teachers.
A teacher of teachers.
A teacher of teachers.
Okay, is that the last big role that you had?
Yes, but not as a talking head, right? Not as somebody who comes in and does a teacher professional. That was even the days before PowerPoint presentations, which now are old fashioned, right?
Well, it depends on where you go, but yeah.
But very low technology, and I got my blackboard or my whiteboard, and I'm doing something, and I've got everybody's attention because they're wondering what am I putting up there. So I'm modeling good teaching as well as having a subject that I'm passionate about and that they can teach about. It's not difficult and it's not complex, no matter what other people say. "Well, that's too complex an issue, I can't teach." No. So I made things teachable, and then I would have superintendents of social studies, history in school districts invite me back year after year because they said I was teaching them just to be good teachers. I would get interrupted. Despite the subject. She is role modeling what I want you to do in the classroom.
Okay.
Apartment. So that was my...
So what was it? What do you think?
The big niche in my professional life was that before I came here to Bali.
Okay. So what was it about the way that you taught? What do you think that was so unique? What is good teaching?
Well, you're going to try to reach all the senses. You're going to do something auditorily and visually. You're going to bring your own excitement to the subject. If you're not excited about a subject, then don't teach it, right? You have to bring your own personal excitement to it and anecdotes that can illuminate something. Yeah, and being aware that I think somebody's done a study that says what you learned in school, in middle school, and high school, you're only going to retain 9% of it. So being aware of, okay, well, what is that 9% I want them to take away? And it's usually a big idea, something personally transformative about that idea. Well, what doesn't matter what the subject is.
Okay.
And I've had friends who are college professors who will come and take my course for middle school and high school teachers and see what I'm doing, and then go back to their college classroom and teach that way and say, oh, all I did was I just stood at the lectern and lectured, right, and said, these are the reading assignments.
Yeah, yeah.
Now I teach.
Yeah. And when you say teach, are you talking about the engaging?
Engaging, right.
Right, okay.
Well, I mean, if you didn't learn it, that's because I didn't teach it.
Okay.
I might have told it to you, I might have told you to read something, but if you didn't retain anything, it's because I didn't teach it to you.
Okay, so define teaching.
Well, it has to be experiential in the classroom, too, even if you've got four walls and 30 desks that are sort of tightly there together. It has to touch them in some way, even if it's the anecdotal story that they remember, that they'll never forget. There's something behind that story. So for example, in a teacher workshop, one of the hands-on things we do is I pass out to them a single piece of paper, and on one column there are proverbs that they say in Arabic, but here they're translated. Here's the Arabic proverbs.
Mm-hmm.
And on this side, the four of you at that table and the four of you at that table, you're going to put your heads together and see if you can come up with some English counterparts for them. And depending on who's at that table, it might be a teacher from Vietnam or a teacher from Italy who says, oh, well, there's an Italian one I know that's just like that one. And pretty soon we see we're not so different from each other.
Mm.
We laugh. We value the same things. We have proverbs for teaching children how to behave.
Mm.
We have proverbs for teaching young people how to choose a spouse, somebody you're thinking of marrying. We have proverbs for every occasion. And they do in every other culture as well.
Okay.
And so that's the big message. They might not remember the proverbs, but they're going to remember, aha, our values are not very different.
So there is there's a connecting through the education for the teaching.
Yes.
Of the students and yourself.
Absolutely.
So you're not really the main person in the room. You're just part of the
facilitating. Hill. Facilitating. Yeah. I'm just facilitating.
Okay.
There.
Okay. Nice. So what brings you to Bali? What brought you to Bali?
I came because I was the youngest son.
Okay.
And I was homeschooling him when we were living in Central America. But I'm not an elementary teacher. My middle school, high school. And I wasn't being successful. Just many things were working, but many things were not. And then I had a friend that came who from the Oakland Public School District, which is the largest school district in the U.S. I didn't know that she was the reading specialist. So she spent about 5 minutes with him and said, you know, he's like 95% an auditory learner.
Hmm.
And you're trying to teach him to the ABCs. He's already 8 years old, right? And it's not working.
Yeah.
And so I looked for another school that could be a school where he could be assisted. And I wasn't interested in him being trusted.
Mm. That's your puppy.
That's my puppy. I want to back up.
Okay.
Because people are wondering, what is a 70-year-old doing with a 10-year-old child? And she's trying to teach him how to read and write. And that's because I had him. He's my fourth child. I had babies at the normal time, my late 20s, my mid to late 30s.
Yeah.
I got three kids. I had him when I was 60.
Okay. Extraordinary.
It's a second marriage. I'm madly in love with a man who doesn't have any children and desperately wants one. And if you'd asked me during all those professionally very productive years that I had, what was the best thing I did was being a mom of three kids running around the house. That was, you know, somebody had said, I didn't have a job. I didn't have a 9-to-5. If somebody had asked me during all of those other years, you know, would you do that again? And I would have said, would you go back and do that again? I said, in a heartbeat, I would have done.
Yeah.
So here's a man that's giving me an opportunity to do that again in a heartbeat. So it was my pregnancy.
Yeah.
And my birth and my everything. That's my child.
Yeah.
And his older siblings, and the youngest, well, there's 23 years difference between him and the youngest of his siblings, that adore him. I think he's the best decision I ever made. Best idea. That's what they said. Mom, he's the best idea you ever had.
Amazing.
So, but I wasn't successful being a homeschooler of this job. So we had been to Bali as tourists, his brother and I and him, and we loved it. And so I said, well, what if we had just come straight to Bali instead of making this detour to Belize, where we lived for 10 years quite happily?
Mm-hmm.
So I looked online, any good schools in Bali, and I said, oh, yeah, actually there's quite a few. But there's this one that looks like it might really serve his needs. So we came here so he could go to that school. And he flourished at school. He flourished at the school. So
that's incredible.
And was there from fourth grade to graduation.
Okay. Fantastic. And now he's working and he's left the school and he's living his life.
He's graduated. He lives in New York City.
Mm-hmm.
Okay.
Yeah. But you stayed in Bali.
Bali's my home. And it's his home, too.
Yeah.
When he would say, where are you from? He's going to say Bali. He's going to say, I'm from Bali.
Even though he was born in the States, lived in Belize.
Born in Berkeley, California, but grew up really in Belize until age 11, I think, and then from 11 to 20. So it's all those formative years that was here in Bali.
Okay. And what's kept you here in Bali? I have to say, you have the most incredible home with books that are ancient and so much material, children's, adults, history, geography, anthropology, religion. Mm-hmm. I just find your home, it's like a...
Well, he used to say, it feels like I live in a library, Mom. And then when I put in the cabinet that became our cabinet of curiosity, he says, now it feels like I'm living in a museum. And he would say both of those in a positive way. It's like, okay, I'm good with
that. That's what it feels like. It feels like a cross between a library and a museum. Everywhere you look, there's something to find, which is amazing. So while you're here in Bali now, what is your intention? I know that you're in your 80s.
Well, I think I'm going to live out my days here. That's my plan. That's my plan. Yeah. But you and I know that we're not in charge. So I'm open to what comes next. For a while, I thought I might end up leaving Bali and living with my son, my other son, who lives in Hawaii.
Okay.
But I think maybe it's going to happen the other way around. I think he's going to find that he wants to come here too.
And your daughter's here as well.
And one of my daughters is here.
Yeah.
It's the culture. It's the people.
Mm.
It's just the kindness. I think really
the kindness. Yeah.
And the patience that people show.
And the community.
Well, let's not forget there are great museums. There's a Reader's Festival. There's every kind of festival. And this is becoming one of the culinary capitals of the world. And we're people who like good food.
And
most importantly, I live entirely on my Social Security. That's my only source of income. So I can do that.
You can afford that here. Okay.
That all comes together to say this is home.
Yeah. It feels like you are where you're meant to be. I mean, it's just it. But I feel also that there's you're a gem that's hidden. Oh. It feels like you're hidden because there's so much richness from you, from everything around you, from what you've created in your home. There's so much richness.
Thank you for saying so.
I'm just curious about, because you are also very open. You're very welcoming. You open your home to everybody, the children at school, the parents, puppies, animals. And I'm kind of curious about what is it that's, what makes you so open? What makes you so open and welcoming? What is it that, is it your beliefs? Is it who you are as a human being? Is it something you've always done?
Hmm. Yeah, I think I've always been this way. I've always greeted each new situation that I've been placed in as like, I want to know the flora and fauna. I want to know the people. I've always treated as a positive thing. So honestly, I think I could live in a small trailer in a trailer park and be just converted whatever SUV or something. And
yeah.
I think I would be content. I hope. Because it may happen. Life could happen.
Yeah, who knows? I mean, who knows? And the opposite could happen.
You know, this just flashed in my mind. Once I did, 1981 was the International Year of the Disabled Person.
Mm-hmm.
And I was asked if I would write a rather definitive piece, but for popular reading, for a magazine, about disabilities in the Arab world, So I threw myself to that task, and in fact was invited to give that as a paper at one of the conferences that took place all around the globe, but this conference actually happened to take place in Libya, which, are you ready? The whole idea for having a year devoted to disabilities came from the Libyans at the United Nations. They said, let's have a year focused on disabilities.
Wow.
With everything, architecture, everything, schooling, all of it. And I love this part. When the Americans came out with their, you know, their brochures and their whatever that their press department put out about this, the Libyans had to point out to the Americans that they got the name of the year wrong. The Libyan intention wasn't that it be an international year for the disabled, but an international year of the disabled. They understand the nuance of those two differences.
That's big.
So it had to, it's very big. So, at that conference where I just happened to deliver that paper, there were disabled Libyans who got up to the stage by whatever mechanism
so means they had.
And just would a tirade against their governments doing too little and not fast enough and all of that you would expect
anywhere
in the world.
Did you attend the conference?
No, I gave a speech at that conference.
Okay.
About disability in the Arab world. How does this tie back to what we were speaking about?
I don't know. It just happens randomly, and I love it.
I usually have a note paper, like if I'm doing a full-day teacher workshop, I know what are the key things I need to keep coming back to that I want to cover.
It just suddenly flashed into your mind. You said it popped into your mind, and you just went, oh, no, it's welcome here, because anything is.
Yeah.
So I am curious about how you are so passionate about the Arab world. Where did that start?
I think to be passionate about the world came from my mother. I think when I was 8 years old, she gave me this huge volume called, and if you look at one of those places where they include reviews, I don't know if they do that on eBay as much as on Amazon, but we're boycotting Amazon, so buy the book from eBay. It's called Richard Halliburton's Complete Book of Marvels.
Okay.
This dilettante, actually he's from, I think, Tennessee or Kentucky, I've forgotten, but he had the means to travel the world and to photograph it and talk about it, and he always had a traveling companion.
Yeah.
And there it was. My mother gave this to me, I think, for my 8th birthday, and I just read it from cover to cover. I wanted to dive in those cenotaphs, those things in on the Mayan Peninsula, you know, where they put treasures down in the bottom. I wanted to see Mecca. I wanted to climb to the top of Mount Olympus. They did all of these things.
Wow.
And so...
So when you were 8 years old, you were super, super excited about the whole thing.
Yes, right. And I think collecting stamps was part of that, looking at the whole world. So, but always with the firm belief that... And actually, one of my children said this back to me. You know that time in your life when you kind of reluctantly, but you have to teach children about not talking to strangers?
Yeah. Yeah.
Well, I had this little girl who said at the end of that lecture of mine, she said, oh, okay, so a stranger is just a friend you haven't met.
Yeah, exactly.
They are teachers, right?
Exactly.
And I had to say, exactly.
Yeah. I find it fascinating how how we live has to adjust according to what education dictates in terms of health and safety.
Right.
And not everybody's a villain.
But that is. Yeah. It's like, I wanted that.
Yeah. Yeah, and that's what you have. Because there's an international community here. And you've traveled a lot.
Mm-hmm.
And you've experienced a lot. So let's go back to what I understand that you have an interest in the entire world, but your passion
was the Arab world.
Yeah.
Two things in high school. Maybe one was junior. I know in high school I had really good history teachers.
Mm-hmm.
I went to high school adjacent to the city of Berkeley. I think I commuted on by bus to get to this smaller school.
Mm-hmm.
Good history teachers. One of my history teachers was missing for a whole week. And we had a substitute teacher. And we didn't find out till later, this is in the 1950s, that he was called to give testimony before McCarthy's un-American Activities Committee.
What?
For teaching what he was... Oh, he offered a course called The Nature of the Non-Western World for high school students.
What?
The Nature...
In the 50s.
In the 50s.
Wow.
And so that was very suspicious. So I had good teachers. I remember doing a quintessential long piece on Islam that I was interested in. Probably most of it taken from National Geographic. It wasn't serious. Mm. I was not an outstanding student.
Yeah.
But then, in high school, our school participated in High School Model United Nations. So the United Nations was created in 1945.
Mm.
And within 10 years, there were high school kids doing Model United Nations.
Mm.
And so kids came from all over California to Berkeley. It was hosted at the university. And we represented countries. And both years that I participated, I represented our school.
Yeah.
You draw a name of a country from a hat. Both years, our school had to represent an Arab country.
Okay. And this is out of a hat.
Out of a hat.
Purely coincidental.
And so to prepare, you need to role play their worldview. You have to interview people in the community. You find Arab Americans who are doing whatever.
Yeah.
You find, that the San Francisco's have something called the Office of the Arab League. You go in the so you do that so that you can role play.
Mm-hmm.
And brilliantly, at the UC campus, the Arab Student Association gave a reception for all those high school kids who were representing Arab countries. I think at the International House on campus.
Wow.
And that was like so many stereotypes falling away. So I knew that I wanted to study international relations.
And that's incredible.
And
do they do that now?
Yes. Grade school participates in High School Model United Nations.
Right.
Over there, I've got a sign up there that says Chad. My son who went to green school, he had to represent Chad, the country of Chad, one year. And that was...
That's just a brilliant idea. I mean, you probably don't even need to travel to do that. You could probably just do it in school.
Yeah. Well, let's see. Did they do something first at green school? They did something Bali-wide or maybe Indonesia-wide, and then they went on to... Their finals took place, I'm going to guess, Singapore.
Mm.
I can't imagine where else it might have taken place.
Okay.
But
so that's your introduction to the Arab world.
And through the idea of international relations.
Yeah. Mm. And so when did you start facilitating programs for people to learn about Muslims?
First I facilitated programs for people to learn about the Arab world.
Yeah.
And along the way, while I was doing those studies, I met this handsome young man from Baghdad. That's my husband and the father of my first three children.
Right.
So we made a life together.
Mm.
But if we were at a cocktail party or some such and somebody would ask him questions related to the Middle East or related to Iraq or Baghdad, he would say, you have to go and talk to my wife.
Yeah.
She's the expert, right?
Yeah.
Not
wow.
Me.
Wow.
So that was it. And then because the need in America was to understand Islam. It switched. And
where did the need come from?
From immigrants. The State Department set up programs where they took in, 40 Afghan families, and we're going to and work with a community to settle those 40 Afghan families in that community. Well, one we've been hearing about in the news a couple months ago was about the settlement of this large Haitian community in, where, Ohio? In a community in Ohio, right?
Okay.
Well, there have been times when they've settled Afghan refugees or Bangladeshi refugees in certain places. And then I would be going in not only to help, well, mostly to help the teachers figure out, you know, who these kids are and who their parents are, and to do a cross-cultural thing as well as the basic what we need to understand. But that was also helping librarians and support staff at schools.
And so your curiosity and your education, your learning, led you to understand Islam and the Muslim world, et cetera, et cetera. When did you become a Muslim yourself?
Well, obviously in all of those years where I was doing the scholarly thing, trying not to be a talking head, I hope I was teaching about Islam respectfully and accurately, you know, and doing that in really good faith. But at a certain point, so in my library I probably got 8 different English translations of the Quran.
Okay.
But at a certain point, God allowed me, in opening the Quran this day, I'm thinking I'm going to do something intellectual, right? That's going to fit something. And suddenly I'm reading it with my heart and not my intellect. And I had to say, oh my gosh, I know you. I've always known you. We've had conversations. I've always had an intimate relationship with whatever we want to call it. My grown children are not very comfortable with the God. I'm comfortable with the God word, whether we use the German word God or the Arabic word Allah. My grown children are more comfortable with the universe. And some people are comfortable with the divine. Whatever works for you is fine. But I knew that entity. So I said, okay, this is speaking to me. This is what I already knew on it. It's already a part of me. So then I said, well, what does that mean? Well, that means that by golly, Muhammad was a messenger. He received this message, and it got written down pretty fast. I may have mentioned once that the portion of the Old Testament that is so much like the Quran is the Psalms of David, the Psalms or Songs of David. And I think the reason that they came, that made that 2,000 year gap between the time that David composed or sang those songs and they actually got written down, it's because they were songs. They didn't get changed. We remember the lyrics. We remember it exactly. And so it's pretty powerful.
Yeah, it's amazing. So when did you take your Shahada? When did that happen?
I think 1992.
Okay.
So that, for me, dear, that's recently.
Yeah.
In 1992, I was 50 years old.
And where was that?
In Cordoba.
Okay.
My husband and I had made a trip to Cordoba. To Al-Andalus, the Islamic part of Spain, Al-Andalus. And we were visiting the Great Mosque in Cordoba. And he just said to me, he said, things happen by Allah. You have something that you come to this mosque to do. He just sensed that. He said, I'm going to go back to the hotel. Because he wasn't a Muslim. My Baghdadi husband was not a Muslim. He was a Christian. But he was cool with that. If you ever asked him, he would say, by religion I'm a Christian, by culture I'm Muslim. Or he'd say, my culture is Islam. What informs me of the world and me and my place is Islam.
So interesting.
So he went back to the hotel, and I just made shahada all by myself in front of that beautiful mihrab, foregoing the instructions that I should do it in the company of other people or an imam or anything. It's just because it's always been one-on-one. Have you been on Hajj?
Yes.
See, I have not. I've been on. But it may be the same. I've done Umrah twice.
Okay.
But the whole, in Umrah too, but in Hajj in very particular, nothing's organized. Mm-hmm. Nobody's telling you what to do. There's nothing you do at this hour of the day or this hour, except if a call to prayer. Yeah, you stop whatever mm-hmm. you're doing in your pilgrimage.
Yeah.
And do that together. The rest of the time, it's a personal conversation, you and Allah.
Mm.
It's not about anybody else.
Yeah. And you're constantly saying, "I am here, God, I am here."
Right. So it's the promise of a one-on-one conversation and relationship.
Yeah.
And I believe that I had that before.
Yeah.
I was a Muslim.
Yeah. Wonderful. So I want to kind of turn our conversation to a different type of trajectory, because I'm sure you're aware of what's happening with our world in terms of the climate. I know you know what's happening politically and even economically, but in terms of climate, one of the reasons that we came here was for Anisa to become more familiar with what's going on, and particularly Green School to be more intuitive in terms of what direction she wants to take rather than being told mm-hmm. which direction to go in. I was just wondering, how do you feel, knowing what you know in terms of the experiences that you've had and even towards your faith and the mm-hmm. way that you practice, which is a day-to-day living example as far as I'm concerned, how do you think your knowledge, because you have books that are over 100 years old here, how do you think that will help support others going forward, knowing the world is practically on its knees from a climate perspective and politically?
But I think the world has been in that place at other points too.
Mm.
And I think that everything that we think is new is
not
old.
it's just a new experience now.
Right.
Yeah.
Right. So I the climate of the world. Well, I think we have to take a bigger look at it. One of the reasons I brought my son here was that I saw that this school, now we've said its name, I saw that this school was, or the founders of the school saw it as a place to prepare green leaders for the 21st century.
Mm.
Okay. And I said, oh, well, they need this boy because he has a different idea.
Yeah.
About what that looks like and how it arrives. You want me to share that?
Yeah, please.
Oh, well, we left California in 2006. One of the big reasons we left was that I saw George Bush destroying the places I love.
Mm.
Baghdad, Damascus.
Mm.
And it was just,
had you visited those places?
Yes,
right?
It was tearing me apart. So that was one of the things that made us leave. In any case, we arrive in Belize, and my son has not yet had his fifth birthday, but he comes up to me and he takes my hand and he holds it like this. He says, "Mama, Mama." He said, "You don't need to be afraid. You don't need to be angry. You don't need to be angry, and you don't need to be afraid. The dunya is deconstructing."
Oh,
I said, four. Now, I only knew the word dunya because it's an Arabic word, but none of my kids speak Arabic. None of my kids. And certainly not him. And so,
where did that come from?
That's what I said. I said, what, sort of, what does that mean? What does that mean, the dunya is deconstructed? He took his little hand, he said, this world that people think is real, it's not real.
Hmm.
This dunya, that's what people think, it's not real.
Mm.
And it's all coming apart. And it's okay.
Wow. That's profound.
You don't need to be angry. You don't need to be afraid.
Mm.
Okay. So, we need leadership for that next phase, for that rebuilding of it when it's all come apart.
Mm.
That's the task. It's huge.
There's also another part of this that I'm wondering, perhaps, which is closer to what is needed, and it's actually dealing with the deconstruction as it happens.
Good point.
Mm-hmm. So creating spaces where people can share what's going on for them, and because it is changing and it will change, and it's faster than we think from what I'm reading and from what I'm hearing. So is what I love about a 4-year-old saying that, in a strange sort of way, it's giving hope.
Yeah, absolutely.
That it's gonna happen. It is happening.
Oh, I didn't disbelieve him for a moment.
Yeah.
I didn't contradict him for a
but it's
a time.
And it's okay that this is the time that change is inevitable. So,
and the kids at Green, so I felt that Green School needed him. They needed that kind of that quiet assurance.
Yeah.
That we're gonna do what we can do. We're gonna do these things.
Do you think this is something that kids have anyway?
It might very well be. I'll tell you that some kids who have gone for a long time through this program become very frightened and very what's the word I'm looking for? Not paranoid, more than unhappy. I may be frightened about the future.
Mm.
You know, really depressed.
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah.
So I'm not the only one. I mean, and my son's not the only one. I think there are a few
many.
Of us.
Yeah.
You know, who will come? They want us to come and give this talk to them. They want this kind of reassurance, so that they can feel that they can move forward in their lives.
Yeah, because it is scary, and it is debilitating, and it is
debilitating.
Depressing.
That's the word.
Yeah, and it's depressing, mm-hmm. and. But I love the fact that a 4-year-old came over to you and said it's okay, that it is happening. Because nobody tells you it's okay that it's happening.
Right.
They're like, no, we're going to stop it. It needs to stop.
If it's okay, it means you don't need to be angry.
Yeah.
And you don't need to be afraid.
Yeah.
He didn't say, don't do anything. He didn't be a passive observer of this. No, not at all. That was not a part of it. Just let go of the anger.
Yeah.
And the fear.
But can this context be translated onto any event that's happening in terms of, you know, not just the wars that are happening at the moment, you know, what's happening in Palestine, in terms of the recent trade agreements mm-hmm. or tariffs that have been imposed across the world? You know, if everybody thought in that way, I mean, one of the things that I have, when Anissa was little, that somebody said to me, which really stuck with me ever since, when she was, it was challenging when she was a baby because she was ill and there was tears and stuff, and somebody said, Milaz, and this too shall pass.
Mm-hmm.
And it's always been, it's been here with me mm-hmm. since then. And I know it will pass.
Right.
But it's like, what happens in that passing?
And I've never taken any of that to be a prescription for passivity.
Mm.
Yeah.
Do you consider yourself an activist?
Absolutely.
Yeah.
Yeah. You know, in small ways and big ways. When we first got to Green School, they ran a scholarship contest to find the greenest student in the world and was going to have a scholarship to Green School. And it happened. But Seth wanted to be in it, and so quite a few Green School kids also wanted to be in it, not just outside of Green School.
Mm-hmm.
It was open to the world. But, so, well, there are a lot of things I could say about it. I don't want to say that. But Seth's program, and I made him do it entirely on his own.
Yeah.
That's my training of National History Day in the United States. If we had an inkling that parents helped put this exhibit together, even if, well, okay, you're sixth grader, so your dad saw that board. All right, we'll allow that. But you know, this has to be your creation.
Yeah.
And Seth really didn't know how to use the laptop. He didn't know how to make a video. Mm. But he figured it out. I'm not even supposed to teach him how to, that was my niece saying.
Giving him the responsibility to do it himself.
This.
Yeah.
So his little video, which was just himself sitting there talking, and he talked about what I learned about being a green human being, mm-hmm. I learned from the people of Belize. So he just recounted things that he learned from people who live closer to nature than most mm-hmm. Westerners certainly yeah. do. And he recited some of the things that they did to be in sync with nature and not to harm nature. Mm-hmm. And then I remember he also said, and my mom doesn't kill ants. Mm. If we have ants in the kitchen, she bakes cupcakes and she makes sure that some of them are outside the door. That's mm. their share.
Right. Yeah,
so that they don't come in. That's something that we do that's something I do as a Muslim. That's something yeah. I learned. It's like, okay, yeah. we're not going to kill these creatures.
Yeah.
And so it was just that. That's activism.
It is. Mm-hmm. It is a form of activism. Yeah. Especially in today's day and age.
Yeah. I mean, it takes recognition that there's this, okay, how do I respond to this?
Hmm.
Of the smallest thing. Ants have invaded my kitchen. To the big things.
Yeah.
They're cutting down trees to make a 4 meter wide road that's not going to go anywhere. Right. Yeah. And then to the big thing. This is just the big thing in my neighborhood.
Yeah,
but then
yeah,
then
yeah.
the big things in the world.
Yeah. Yeah. So what do you do in your community then?
Well, I'm obliged to know and be aware of 40 families around me. I was taught this by a Muslim friend in New Mexico.
Okay.
And why she couldn't join me.
40 families.
I was in a dispute that became a legal dispute with somebody that was in that circle of hers. And she said, I can't join you on this because that would put me at odds
with
my neighbor. And I have to stay on. And I'm supposed to know, do they have enough to eat?
Yeah.
Do they need help with anything? Yeah. Have they got a sick child?
Hmm.
Just think if we put that out to the world.
Can you imagine?
As a responsibility. Eat.
And it's so simple.
It is.
It's really
maybe
not
40
rocket,
is too big
so.
Of a number, but
yeah.
I can certainly do 10.
Yeah, or even in your street.
Yes, like exactly.
The people that you live in mm-hmm. the same street
that's
with.
Right.
Which I do sense that that's happening more and more. Like people are becoming more aware locally about what is needed in the community in which they live in, where their children are growing up, where the elders are living. Mm-hmm. And I think people are becoming more aware of how important it is to engage locally.
So there might have been on the cusp of it when I was raising my own children in Berkeley.
Mm.
But we were a community of not too many. I think I was the only stay-at-home mom. Of grandmothers at the park, at the little
yeah.
sandbox with
yeah,
their kids. That was a little community.
Yeah.
The school
yeah.
that your children go to that then becomes a community with parent, teacher
yeah.
organizations.
Mm-hmm.
But still, we didn't know very much or didn't socialize with the people on our own block.
Yeah. And that's the key.
Yeah, that's the key.
That's the key. That's the neighbor thing.
That was yeah. missing. Just a hello.
Yeah, but not real engagement.
Not engagement.
Yeah. Okay, so what about internationally? What's your activism there?
Well,
right now, in this moment.
Okay.
Because it could change.
Well, the activist role that I've played since the 1967 war, Palestine has been my key activist issue. And right now, isolated as I am, we haven't had any demonstrations here, right? There's no reason for me. I guess I could fly over to Jakarta and be in a big mass demonstration. I'm not even sure they take place. Number one, because I don't have any TV.
Yeah.
So I rely on the internet for my news.
Yeah.
I'm sad to say that mostly it's my Facebook presence.
Okay.
I'm very aware of those 700 or 800 people that follow me on Facebook.
Mm-hmm.
And sometimes I'll post things that to my activist friends who are active on Palestine, who are a piece of my Facebook presence. Like, it's a baby step.
Yeah.
Yeah. But I have a sense of where people that are on my Facebook post, where they are
okay.
in terms of their background knowledge
mm-hmm.
and their ability maybe to commit
yeah.
to something
Yeah.
So for some of those people alike, a thumbs up is like, okay, that's,
you've touched something.
Right. So that's my teaching. That's my major teaching.
Okay.
My activist.
Okay. And I know that from the conversations that we've had so far, how many people you know, like in politics, in education. I mean, you're very humble about the whole thing, but I know that we have a lot of connections. Do you use any of these connections with your activism?
Actually, most of them have passed away.
Okay. How old are you again?
I'm 83. Okay. But I'm the people that I look to that were my mentors were a decade older than me, like Edward Said and Ibrahim Abolhoggood and Yasser Arafat. We were once a little small,
Yeah.
You could count on the fingers of both hands.
Yeah.
The activist community on these issues. So most of them has passed. But I'll give you an example.
Mm-hmm.
That the Palestinians and Israeli peace people were meeting in Madrid. Peace talks opened in Madrid, and they were sincere, and Palestinians were able to send their own leaders to negotiate that. When the United States got wind of it, it undercut those Madrid meetings by something called the Oslo Accords,
right?
Where the Israelis chose who would be the Palestinian. Well, and in any case, we're not debating the Oslo Accords. When it came time for those Oslo Accords to be signed on the White House lawn, so this tells you who's really the person behind the scenes.
Yeah.
My husband and I got an invitation from Bill Clinton to attend that, to fly to Washington and attend that ceremony. And my kids were all they were teenagers. I said, oh my God, are you guys going? Are you going? And we said, no. And they said, why? And we said, because neither your dad nor I are Palestinians.
Yeah.
So we have to take our cues from Palestinian friends in leadership positions.
Mm-hmm.
And Edward Said resigned from the Palestine National Council. Ibrahim Abolhoggood resigned from the Palestine National Council over these issues of the Oslo Accords. So, no, we're not going.
Mm-hmm.
So that's how small.
Very small. Okay.
I put together a panel for the National Council for the Social Studies. That's history teachers all over the United States coming together. And it was a panel on, it was a panel about Middle East. Was it a panel on Palestine? It was a panel on Palestine.
Mm-hmm.
And Congressman Pete McCloskey, who was the sitting congressman at the time, was going to chair the panel for me. And we had Israeli peace people, we had Palestinian activists who were going to be on the panel.
Yeah.
That was
what
one of...
What year was this?
I'm going to say maybe 86?
86.
I'm not good with dates.
Okay.
I had put five proposals together. It was going to be one called Storytelling, What We Can Learn About Islam from Folktale Traditions, of Art, of all kinds of things.
Mm-hmm.
And I heard back from each one, but I didn't hear back of confirmation that the Palestine one had been accepted for presentation. And I have people waiting for me to arrange their flights to wherever it was that was held. And so I called them and they said, oh, didn't you get our letter? Didn't you get the letter that, isn't room for that one. There isn't room for that. Well, I knew what that meant.
Mm-hmm.
That Zionist didn't want that one to be presented. So I looked at who's the keynote speaker at this meeting is Ali Mazruri. Do you remember him?
No.
Dr. Ali Mazruri? He's a Kenyan scholar. He's the one who did the PBS series called The Africans.
Okay.
But where the first time an African gets to tell the story of African history.
Wow.
So he was then the Albert Schweitzer chair at Sonny Binghamton University in New York City. And I said, I need to talk to Ali Mansour because he's the keynote speaker. If he threatens to withdraw. So how do I reach him? I call Ibrahim Abolhoggood, who chairs the political science department. I forget where.
Yeah.
Somewhere in the Midwest. I said, Ibrahim, can I reach Ali Mazruri? He said, what's it about? Audrey, he's a member of the Palestine National Council. And I told him the story. He said, oh, I'll take care of it. And within 24 hours, my proposal to do that panel on Palestine was back.
Wow.
On the program.
So you knew people.
Because Masrouri said, I won't come.
And how did it go?
Wonderful. Oh, well, it's very interesting. It was a packed room.
Yeah.
It was a packed room. And the Zionists in the room didn't offer arguments to what was being presented. They didn't counter any arguments. They just would stand up and shout and make it very uncomfortable for people. So their goal was to make it uncomfortable for people.
And
people got up and left. People got up and left. They didn't want to be a part of this. This is, But the people that stayed in the room got angry because they saw, they understood what was happening, and it went forward. So it was okay.
But even that was probably needed for people to
see,
become aware.
Well, and their goal in making this uncomfortable was, this is what will happen in your classroom if you open up this topic for discussion in your classroom.
Well, it does happen in the classroom.
Yeah, this is what's going to happen. You're going to have parents coming down and just screaming at you.
Yeah, and then schools
told
what it
was.
Talk
it was
about
it. Screaming.
Yeah,
it
yeah,
was
yeah.
about screaming at the presenters.
Well, that's pretty emotional, emotive behavior, isn't it, really?
But those that stayed around got a good education. They
I can imagine.
You're not going to intimidate me.
This nonsense. Yeah. So I know it's like not in our hands and we haven't got a crystal ball and things like that, but if somebody's listening to this and they're feeling quite, well, we all are feeling really dejected about the whole thing.
I'm so hopeful right now.
See, this is what
what I was describing, me calling a member of the Palestine National Council who's calling the Masrouri, we were just like, And if we met at the United Nations, there might be 30 of us out of the whole world.
Yeah.
Look at now. It's not in the hands of America anymore.
Yeah, it's bigger.
It is bigger.
It can't. There is a lot more awareness.
Oh, my God.
You're excited?
I'm excited. Yes. I mean, I'm destroyed about the price.
That's been paid.
By children.
Yeah.
But the possibility of seeing someone else leveraging the going forward, and it's not going to be just the hands of the United States and Israel to decide who gets to talk for the Palestinians, for example.
Yeah.
And because the rest of the world knows what I don't know if you know this about the American media, but Americans think they may talk about a two-state solution. They don't know that the United Nations already recognizes Palestine as an independent, sovereign state. It just has this problem that the UN can't resolve, and that is there are soldiers of a foreign country in that Palestinian state, and there are settlers of a foreign country who are in that Palestinian state, and how do we get them out of there? That was voted in 1989. 126 countries said Palestine exists. They have a seat at the United Nations. They're no longer, it used to be that the Palestine Liberation Organization and the African National Council were observers. No, Palestine is a full member of the United Nations.
It is. I've seen it.
126 members.
Yeah.
Two countries only, there were, I think, 108 voted for it, 26 abstentions.
Yeah.
Two countries only said no.
Yeah. Well, that's a huge sign anyway. Yeah.
So if that's it, and the whole rest of the world, there are embassies of Palestine in every capital city in the world.
Yeah.
Here in Jakarta, and not just Muslim countries, everywhere in the world, there are ambassadors. Except in the United States, they think this, they have no idea that this is even taking place.
Yeah, but it's so, I mean, I hear you in terms of, like, the awareness is growing and people are recognizing, I mean, even the word
but
Palestine.
But they're demanding. They're not just aware.
Yeah, they are demanding. But it also feels quite, it also feels like the power to do anything about it is not in our hands, but actually it is.
It is.
And the media has a lot to answer for. I mean, I think that's the thing that kind of brainwashes or gives people a perspective.
I don't watch TV, so I just watch the Western media.
But I came off social media. I stopped watching the media in early 2000s anyway. But I feel like I do sense that if it wasn't for social media, we wouldn't know half of what was going on in Palestine. Right. So there's a good and a bad, there's a yin and a yang. Mm-hmm. It's like the light and the shadow is everywhere. Right.
There's no hiding it anymore.
No, it's open. Everybody knows.
Everybody.
No matter how much emotional, people are emotionally attached to one way or another, mm-hmm. the facts are there. And, mm-hmm. you know, there's a lot of murdering going on. So, you know, you're saying that you're feeling hopeful because a lot more people know and there's more awareness. What would you like to see have happen?
Oh, that's not up to me. I'm not Palestinian.
See, I love that answer.
No, people used to say, even when those activists, those heady activist days at the UN or something, said, oh, will you support a two-state solution? I said, that's not my business.
Yeah.
That's the business of the Palestinians.
Yeah.
I'm just here in solidarity towards this. That's all.
Whatever they want.
Whatever they want. Mm. And they didn't want the Oslo Accords. That was a horrible day. Yasser Arafat basically agreed to negotiate unilaterally this country, so that block was missing. Now that block is huge.
Something. Okay. So you want what the Palestinians want, and I know they want their freedom.
Well, because I believe in self-determination.
Yeah, for every human being on the planet.
Exactly.
Not control over others.
And that's what the Arab countries, there weren't a lot of countries that were members of the United Nations in 1948 that made that decision to divide Palestine. But there were a significant number of Arab nations. That's what they wanted. They wanted the UN to send people to Palestine and ask the people and take a vote. Called a plebiscite in political science language. Find out. Mm. Take a vote.
Let people vote.
Yeah. Ask them.
Yeah.
And instead the opposition says the Arab states, Israel declared its independence and the Arab states opposed it. Don't tell me what they opposed. Tell me what they wanted. No American textbook ever said that. Told you what they wanted.
The narrative is very different now.
Yeah. Self-determination.
Mm. There's something that you mentioned the other day that I'd like to bring up in terms of like egocentric and biocentric.
In this conversation, we're going to move to there.
Okay. Yeah, I actually, unless you want to say more.
No.
Because I think what self-determination is where it's at the end of the day.
Right.
And I think that's the bottom line for all humanity.
Yes. Absolutely. Oh, it's really scary.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
I think for me, it was about this issue of biocentrism versus egocentrism. Mm.
Yeah. So when you talk about biocentric and egocentric, can you define? I mean, I looked it up online the other day.
So there
is a description.
Okay.
But what is it in your mind? What do you define biocentric as?
Let me. That's an anecdote.
Yeah.
Right?
Yeah.
I'll tell you a story, and then you'll remember. Okay, this is the defining thing. The school has turnover teachers every year, new teachers, and certainly every year a new counselor.
Mm-hmm.
And so Seth has been in the school for maybe 4 or 5 years, and It's September, and I'll get an email requesting that I come in and talk to a teacher. And this happens every September, and it's always a new teacher.
Yeah.
And I'm always told that my son has low self-esteem.
Yeah.
And that's where, at first it was just me trying to explain, and then I came to understand, it's because you're judging self-esteem from attributes of personality.
Mm.
What do you see? How does he talk? Does he command a group? What are the things that you're looking for that show self-esteem? those are attributes of his personality that's controlled by the ego. That,
yeah.
His self-esteem is here.
Mm.
It's soulful. It's soulfully driven.
Mm.
And it's just fine.
Mm.
Okay. So, but the, then again, this is mom talking, right?
Yeah.
I could see the person over there thinking, okay, this one's over. So as I'm leaving school, I meet teachers that have known him for 2, 3, 4 years. I said, oh, I just had the meeting about Seth having low self-esteem. And they go, pah!
That's very nice.
They know.
Yeah.
They know. Yeah, right.
Oh, actually, it really is quite insightful in terms of where the judgment is coming from.
Mm-hmm. And what is value?
What, and how we project as humans onto the children that we're serving.
Mm-hmm.
But values as well, absolutely. Absolutely, which I find really interesting.
That we're looking at those attributes of someone's personality.
Yeah.
And determining.
Yeah, who they
are. Their own care of their own selves.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
Absolutely.
And so I started calling him biocentric and egocentric. And then I learned that this was a big topic of discussion in the 18th century. But even earlier, Thomas More was talking about biocentric.
Mm.
But then it seemed that Freud sort of put the kibosh on that,
right?
Oh, that's that soul stuff, and there's no
it's not real.
Isn't really real.
Yeah.
Like, we're all governed by this.
Yeah.
And
And the impact of that is very obvious.
It's very obvious.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. And you know what? I love, Audrey, the way that you just use a story as an anecdotal example of what this means. Do you think an environment like the green school actually helps to help children to explore the difference between the two?
I think they could do a better job with the biocentric aspect of it. It's always been a kind of a touchy-feely thing. Oh, we're going to spend 20 minutes on mindfulness today.
Yeah.
And maybe with exercises or something. That's not what we're talking about.
Yeah.
We're talking about going to sit in a tree for a couple of hours. Give the kid a spade and let him dig a hole and sit in the ground.
Yeah.
Let
them be.
Just let them be.
In nature.
And don't... Yeah. I mean, so here I have this son who I'm telling you is like... He's bio, he's, the dunya is deconstructing. Here he is. And he's having to sit in a session called mindfulness and writes a paragraph. Oh, my God. It's like, But it's a nice concept, but it's not that. It's not the way
it's not handled. Really where they drive, the kid is driven.
Do you know the Yusuf Ali translation of the Quran? The English translation of the Quran.
Yes,
he did that in the early 30s.
Yeah.
He translates a word that God uses as mindfulness. Be mindful. Be mindful. Be mindful.
Yeah.
It's not a buzzword of the 21st century. Mindfulness.
Be mindful and reflect.
Right. So see, everything that we think is new, mindfulness,
it's already been there.
It's there.
And even from my professional standpoint, where I look at coaching as a profession,
mm-hmm.
I might make myself unwelcome here. But, you've gone from capitalism to therapy, which is holding the people that are in capitalistic society to explore and go deep, et cetera, et cetera. And it's questions related to your mum and your dad and your upbringing and your parents and blah, blah. But then you go, then that's evolved to the next stage of coaching, which is more a soul-aligned spiritual space, as far as I'm concerned anyway, which has actually got me into a lot of trouble because I've let go of the bodies and the thing that...
No, there was a third little wave in there in between the... on the couch, let's explore your past history and maybe your past lives to
coaching. Yeah.
And that was, because my husband was in the mental health field and he was really big on, oh gosh, I'm thinking of the term, It's a behavior modification.
Okay. Yeah. Right?
Yep. We're not going to look at all of that past. We're just going to deal with the now.
We're just
going to deal with the now.
Okay, and
fix things.
Yeah, and that's where coaching has come into play. So it is about the now.
Okay.
Coaching is about the now. It's not about looking at the history and things like that. So that must have evolved to coaching.
Sure.
Mm-hmm. Which has now become...
So people don't use the term behavior modification anymore.
No, I mean...
Because that's pretty active and somehow I...
It is. Well, mm-hmm. coaching is very reflective,
okay.
as far as I'm concerned.
All right.
I mean, there are different ways of coaching. Mm-hmm. It's very reflective, but also it does touch on the behavior because we, as our at the level of identity, we are not our behavior, but behavior is always purposeful because it depends on the beliefs, the situation, where we're at right now, and the behavior responds to that. So... As far as the identity is concerned, we are who we are, and we're not. The behavior doesn't touch it because you know you go into a child and you say you are naughty.
Mm-hmm.
You know we're associating their identity to being naughty, and that's then who they think that they are. But they're not. They can be naughty, and they're more than that.
Right.
You know?
But I think of behavior modification as like we're going to reward what we regard as good behavior, and we're going to just ignore.
The bad behavior.
I mean, give it the attention that we give to good behavior.
Yeah.
I'm doing that with my new puppy now. I have a new puppy.
Yes.
And scolding her doesn't work as good
as
loving her because she wants to please. So if we make that connection, she wants to please me. I can see that.
Yeah.
But not if I ignore her. I need to give her daily attention. And then when I want good behavior,
isn't this all related to anthropology though? That's the study of humans and animals, and this is what it's saying time and time again. It's how we look at the behavior, and it's not really about the behavior. And so when we see behavior and we give it a punishment, you know, that affects the human at a level of identity, and they think that they're bad, and then that causes more behavior of the same.
Of course.
So it's really interesting, and I do find now, even Bali wasn't really a conscious choice, it was a school, but coming
to,
but the country and the way that people live at a very hyper-local level, the local community, and they resolve their issues without getting somebody with a notebook and a policeman saying, right, what happened here? And
it's the Banjar system. It's just brilliant.
It's amazing. Like,
and I was aware of that kind of... I was aware that that takes place in the Middle East. And in fact, Laura Nader, that's Ralph Nader's sister.
Mm-hmm.
He has more than one sister. I can't think of the other one's name. Laura was the first woman to become chair of a department at UC Berkeley.
Mm-hmm.
She was the chair of the anthropology department.
Okay.
And she initiated a new field of study called law and anthropology.
Interesting.
Because the law is like black and white, right?
Yeah.
But when you go out and look at how do communities solve issues that are not... Yeah, but there may
black
be some... There may be some black and white, but that's not how they choose to resolve it.
Yeah. They engage. Yeah.
And solve it in a way that a community would solve. That's the anthropology of it. It's brilliant. And they do that here in Indonesia.
Yeah. But I find that so rich.
Mm-hmm.
It's like, you know, if we're not looking at the... If we're outside of the global north, which is a majority of capitalistic society... This is the reason why we came here, is to explore and be in a country that is in the global south. It's not, you know, it's not the Islamic country that, you know, I thought that we would experience, and maybe that will happen.
I think I was going to live out my days in Bali. You know, I know where I would have chosen. I would have chosen Egypt, I think, holds my heart. Or some other place, Lebanon or Damascus or
Tunisia
or something. Yeah. But here I am.
Yeah. But what I love about it is that I don't feel like I'm in a structured society which has a constitution underneath it that everybody abides by.
Mm-hmm.
It's almost like the natural ability and the natural human instincts are there to help resolve the issues that are happening in the community. And we've lost it.
Right.
And I feel it a lot in terms of before we came out here. You know, I felt it feels heavy that you can't just resolve an issue. Because, no, the first thing you do when something bad happens is you report it to a body.
Mm-hmm.
And then they need to then write it down, and then you need the evidence.
There's
and that
comes
that.
Out with his notebook, and he puts it open and takes down, okay.
And then
what?
And then it goes to the courts, and then it goes further and further and further, and it affects your entire existence. And I find that being here has taught me that none of that, it's just noise that is not required, because you can resolve things. I've seen, you told me about the Banjar resolving issues in community between people. But nobody, I think everybody wants a resolution. I don't think nobody wants to sit in a place of conflict.
Right. And I've seen that happen in the Middle East. And Laura Nader was very familiar with that, because the Naders are Lebanese. Zahle, Lebanon is where their family's from. So she saw that as a young adult visiting the homeland of her parents and seeing how issues get resolved. It can be a case, it can be technically a case of manslaughter or whatever it is, but if this man is responsible for my losing my husband and the support of myself and my, it doesn't do any good to put him in prison. How does that help us? So the community would decide by whatever means, but it would be something like, okay, you continue to work, but you're going to provide support for this woman and children, make sure the children go to school if they want to go to university. I mean, whatever the community decides is applicable, but they now become your responsibility. And locking you away somewhere isn't
the answer.
Doesn't serve the community.
Doesn't
serve the community.
But it's also,
so that's just like one example. I was in a medical office one day in Berkeley, and I was telling this story to an elderly gentleman, now I'm the elderly woman, about how this works in the Middle East, and he was from the American South. He said, "Oh, in the American South, in my community, I forget what state it was." He said, "If you killed somebody, they tied the body of the dead person to your body
as the murderer.
Yes, and you had to live with that body on you, walking, waking, sleeping, eating, whatever, bathing. I forget for how much, a week,
for a long time.
Yeah, a week would be an enormous amount of time.
Yeah, a day would be more than enough.
A day would be more than enough. Yeah. So that was that community's
way of dealing with it.
Dealing with it, instead of taking your life, a life for a life.
Interesting.
Wow, I laughed at that. I said, oh my God, I wonder if Laura Nader knows about that.
That will just actually stop anyone from committing any sort of murder of the sight of a sort. If you were, I'm going to ask a really odd question. If you were the leader of the world, what is the first thing that you would do? What is the first thing you would do? Somebody put you in charge of the planet.
Yeah, but I would just say something. Nobody would pay attention to it. I hope
they have to listen.
I am accepting of the unity of God, but that beyond that, no. Oh, I want to tell you, the unity of God. A question that I would often get in a teacher workshop is Islam, because of the belief in Allah, is Islam compatible with democracy? No. Yeah.
Okay.
And I remember a brilliant fellow that used to come with me sometimes, especially if I was doing one in the San Francisco Bay Area, I'd say, Aga Saeed, come on with me. And he got that one. He said, I want to broaden it a bit. I want to ask, is monotheism compatible with democracy? So see, the one person's going to be the ruler of the world.
Yeah.
Is monotheism compatible with democracy?
Yes. That's really interesting. Shall I tell you why? Because we recently went to Brunei for a visit, and it seems like this tiny country. I don't want to set it too much because everyone might want to go there and live there. But it feels peaceful. And you have a king and a queen. And he is the president and the prime minister, right. And he is everything to that country. And he looks after, he has money, and he looks after his people. There is no poverty, there is no, I don't know, I didn't see, I mean, there were police officers around mm-hmm. the palace, and there are, you know, service personnel to kind of protect the country.
A benign dictator.
But what I find interesting is, you know, everybody looks for a leader. Even me, I'm like, which is the best country to live in with the best leader who will look after its people?
No, it's just
a silly thing, because we're all human.
Nobody looks to a leader.
The king is a human.
Does your child look to her parents to make decisions, or is she?
No, we encourage her to make the decisions.
Then why do you want to invest that in another human being? Yeah, exactly. No, democracy. Small d democracy means people make those decisions. Small d democracy.
I like that. Small d democracy.
Yeah, that's.
I've never heard of that phrase before.
It means one person, one vote.
Yeah.
Yeah, so you've only seen it capital D? That means you're a member of a party.
Which is the way the West functions.
Small D democracy.
Because everybody has to be with a party.
Do we have another 10 minutes?
Yeah.
Okay, this is where I need my whiteboard.
Okay. I don't have a whiteboard.
Okay.
Do you have a whiteboard here?
No.
Okay.
So you just have to imagine.
Yeah.
All right. In Arabic. Maybe some other languages too, I'm sure. Well, Persian, which is written with the same alphabet, mm-hmm. the same script. There are no upper and lowercase letters.
Mm.
No capital letters, no little letters.
Mm.
Okay, there's just one way to write a word. So when you're translating it, you may be making assumptions.
Yeah.
Because you may be changing something that's a verb to an adverb.
Yeah.
Okay, like, that's why small d Democrat is about democracy, it's not the... You could call yourself a Democrat and not believe in democracy.
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah.
Okay. So, Islam. I'm going to tell you about Arabic. Is most words come from a three-consonant root.
Mm-hmm.
If it's a word that has four consonants, maybe, probably borrowed from another language. Arabic, three-consonant root. And you change that just slightly by adding prefixes and suffixes.
Okay.
So the three consonant root of Islam is S-L-M.
Okay. Yeah.
That word means, and most Muslims will say to somebody who doesn't, what does it mean? We might say it means peace or surrender or submission.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. So when I was starting to work with teachers, I said, for speakers of English, the word surrender and the word submission, those are loaded words.
Yeah, yeah.
We don't like that. That sounds like slavery or something, right? Those are not good words in English.
Yeah.
So I took my dictionary down. So I look under those three letters. You know what the first word I see for a meaning of that?
What?
Reconciliation.
Oh, wow.
Reconciliation. Then you start reading the Islam, peace, blah, 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 blah.
Reconciliation.
So reconciliation, it has layers of meaning.
Yeah, like with who and how. And
it's all about God.
Yeah.
It's all about the divine. And reconciliation all, and I don't want to say something that's not true, so I was thinking of its counterpart in Hebrew, which is shalom.
Mm-hmm.
So people know that means peace, just like salam means
peace.
But that idea of reconciliation also has with it, it does bring peace, because all the loose parts, all of these things that are swirling around in your head and your, you know, it all comes together. It's all reconciled.
Mm.
Hmm? It's not just about human reconciliation, but it's about peace. Disparate pieces and ideas become reconciled. Or they do, don't they?
Yeah, they do.
So, and all of these, all of those words describe a relationship with God.
Yeah.
Reconciled, peaceful, non-violent, peaceful as in non-violent, submission, surrender. Okay, blah, 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 blah. Okay. We see that. Okay, the Prophet Muhammad embodied all of those.
Yeah.
The Quran tells us that Jesus and Abraham embodied all of those, particularly surrender, submission, Abraham too, Moses, submission, surrender. Okay, so now, so you change this three consonant root that describes a relationship with God, and you put a in front of it.
Mm-hmm.
You're talking about the embodiment of that relationship in a person.
Yeah.
So if a person embodies those things, then in Arabic grammar, the only word for that person is Muslim. And remember, we're talking about small case letters.
It's just fascinating.
It's the only word.
Yeah.
So of course the Quran says that Abraham is a Muslim and Jesus is a Muslim. We wouldn't want him to call, we wouldn't want it to be called something else in Arabic.
So it's the Arabic word.
It's the Arabic word for that that thing that embodies all of those qualities is a Muslim. When we spell that with a capital M, we've made ourselves into a private club. Oh yeah, I got a pocket. I got a membership card right here. See, capital M Muslim, and it means I got to stand in that line. But you got to, if you're a capital C Christian, you got to stand in that line.
So, which is egocentric, it's not
biocentric. And divides us.
So it's not biocentric.
And it divides us.
Yeah.
It makes artificial
separation.
And since those other faiths also come from a language with the same roots, no capital letters, no small case letters. Mm. Well, how do we change that? When we start putting capital letters, we divide, we make divisions between our heart and our ability to act in the world.
Yeah.
Because we're forcing people to stand in different lines.
Yeah. Yeah.
No capital letters. Small and Muslim. So it's quite natural. So sometimes
it's quite humbling to hear you talk like that.
Sometimes, I mean, I will describe, when people say, are you a Muslim? I say, first of all, I remember that when I was a child, my mother taught me, maybe I'm going to go around the world and somebody's going to ask, are you a Christian? My response, if you'd asked me then, are you a Christian? My response would be, I'm trying to be. Trying to be. I understood that it was a verb. It's a way of being. It's not a club.
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah.
So I took that same idea, especially when I did the Arabic, no capital letters. All right, this is a verb. So if people ask me, are any of my children Muslim? Right. Right now, I'm very comfortable to say two of them and possibly three of them are small M Muslims.
Yeah.
And that's enough. That's the most important, right? Yeah. A small M Muslim.
Because who knows where their journey will end up.
Right.
And you
understand that means they haven't made their shahada.
Yeah.
Right. They haven't declared, I am a Muslim.
Yeah.
But they're in that.
They're the meaning. Really,
they're in the meaning. They're a small M Muslim. Like, I'm a small D Democrat too. I believe in that. I try to practice it. So no, I'm not going to be the leader of anything. I mean,
I'm elected. And then?
Okay. If I'm elected the president of the stamp club in sixth grade, or the president of the International Students on College Campus, which I was, that's different. That's democracy. That's small d democracy. Mm. That's what we said earlier, called self-determination.
I find this whole thing fascinating. I could talk to you for hours. Okay. I could talk with you for hours. Thank you so much. Is there anything you'd like to end with? I know you have you find storytelling incredibly powerful. I mean, I do too, but I'm surrounded by storytellers here in Bali.
But you can see that my stories are illuminating.
Yeah. So
a big question I want you to grapple with. I remember the one time that Green School allowed, a thematic to be about Islam, and it was going to end in a banquet, and that's my curriculum. In the Alhambra Palace. And I had to get it down to a single nugget. What is this about? I said, okay, teachers, here it comes. This is Wiggins and McTee, who are the great curriculum designers. I said, it's always about the teachers have a basic question. They don't just say to the kids right on the board, this is a big question that we're, no, but everything you do has to revolve around this.
Mm-hmm.
I said, if it's about Islam, then I want the big question to be, what is the purpose of knowledge?
Mm.
And so all of the stories, everything you're doing is going to help you on that journey to come to some kind of answer to that. What's the purpose of knowledge?
Thank you. Can we leave it at that?
Yeah.
Thank you. Thank you so much.
I love you. I'm so glad you've come into my life.
Alhamdulillah. There's always a reason for everything. Beyond the reason of the reason of the reason.
That we think is the reason.
Yeah.
The school brought us here.
Exactly.